Hey, Larry, how's it going?
Hey there, doing great.
Awesome. This was an exciting week. It was Halloween, so most of our people had to stay at home, probably with the lights off and be in by some almost like dinner time, and you're like in sixth grade waiting for mom to have dinner ready. And so it seemed like it might be an appropriate time for us to cover the rules of being on supervision and what probation can and cannot do to you, what rules and restrictions can they place upon you while you are on probation?
So you used the terminology there regarding supervision and probation because there are a variety of things that are considered supervision other than probation. So we can probably delve a little bit broader into the various forms of supervision as we go out this interview.
Okay. Do you want to do that first, right off the bat, and talk about the different types of supervision that there might be?
Sure, we can do that.
Cool. So
So we'll
obviously we have like supervised and unsupervised or parole and probation.
So we have probation, which is something that's imposed by a court after a plea or a finding of guilty of an offense. And as we go through this, there are also forms of probation that don't necessarily follow from a conviction. They're used as diversion programs, but we'll focus first on what comes as a result of conviction. There are times when people's behavior doesn't rise to the level of needing to be separated from society. And a judge will impose a period of probation supervision. And they can also impose a period of unsupervised probation, but we'll look at supervised probation first, which is the more common. When a court imposes a period of probation supervision, they're always attached to conditions of that supervision, which are referred to as general conditions, standard conditions, and special conditions. And the special conditions are, in theory, tailored to that individual offender and their characteristics and the offense pattern to try to bring their behavior within the acceptable limits of society and to help move them towards living a productive, law-abiding life. So conditions of probation can be very unique depending on the particular offender in terms of special conditions. And then there's the standard conditions that typically apply to everyone. Those general conditions of probation, and they vary from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. There'll be conditions like don't leave the state, or in really large geographic states, there'll be don't leave the county without permission, refrain from using alcohol, don't possess weapons, don't associate with known felons that are detrimental to your rehabilitation. Of course, don't break any laws. That's the whole point of probation. So those are standard conditions, and then there might be special conditions that would be unique to the offense. If a person could benefit from psychological counseling, there might be a condition that they seek anger management in the cases of domestic abuse, or there might be conditions regarding restitution. There might be conditions don't patronize certain type of establishments because that contributed to the offense pattern. So it wouldn't be unusual for a person who had been engaging in compulsive behavior that resulted in criminality to be told you can't hang out at a casino.
All right.
So they can be pretty broad in terms of special conditions.
Do you think that, how do I want to phrase this? It would seem that a lot of those conditions have almost nothing to do necessarily with the crime that you committed. For example, they say that you can't have alcohol, just, and I know where this is going to go, but just for the example, you can't have alcohol, yet in your case, the crime did not include alcohol, but you still can't have alcohol.
I agree that conditions of supervision tend to be overly broad, and it's easier to paint with a broad brush than it is to require individualized analysis and thought. So there's some evidence that criminality can be more common with those who abuse alcohol and drugs. So it's easier to tell everybody, well, don't consume alcohol. But the problem with that is that alcohol is legal.
Right.
So if it did not lead to a problem for that individual in breaking the law, I think it's an overly broad condition. But unfortunately, until that's litigated in the courts, so the courts agree with people that they're going to continue to impose that as a is a standard condition of probation. And in some jurisdictions, they'll say don't use it excessively rather than refrain from using alcohol. So it's not a uniform prohibition. It varies from jurisdiction to jurisdiction.
Another one that I see, one that just kind of tickles me, is it says don't associate with known felons, yet they send you to treatment with felons. And perhaps people at your church or other organizations where you have people that are, you know, quote unquote, upstanding citizens could be felons, yet they've made a blanket order that says you can't be around them. But those are possibly the people that can, A, relate to your situation, and they would be a positive example for you to move forward and get past what you did and screwed up.
Well, in terms of the association with felons when you're in treatment, that's a controlled environment. So I don't think we could look at that as being what is intended. What is intended is that the personal relationships that people are engaging in, they don't want you going out and selecting felons as being your best friends. But if you're in a rehabilitative environment or a church or a synagogue or whatever where you're, these are not personal associations, these people just happen to be there incidental to whatever purpose is taking place in that setting, I would contend that that's not what the prohibition is designed for. Unfortunately, I see or hear horror stories about people are being told that they can't go to something that's being put on as a group effort, and it's not a personal association, but they're being told you can't go there because there are other felons there, so which is exactly what you're talking about. If you go to church, I would be surprised if you could find a church that didn't have felons, because there's such a significant number of felons as a percentage of our population.
Yeah.
So it'd have to be a very small church. It would be very unique not to have any felons in the congregation. So, but you're not going there as a personal association. You're going there to worship,
mm-hmm.
and to take part of a church program and getting information about God and whatever people do in churches. So it's not like you've selected these people personally. They just happen to be there incidental to the function of the church.
Same with, I think you're referring to the conference in Atlanta last year.
That would be where I would see that. That was a group of people coming to learn and gain knowledge about asserting their constitutional rights and trying to figure out how to reform the laws and petition government for redress of their grievances. It just happened to be that some of the people at that conference had convictions, but a whole lot of people there at that conference did not. And the people that came to that conference didn't choose who was going to be there.
Same with
no more than you
could have
going to be in the church.
Right. And same as you could get a job and that place happens to be felon friendly and you end up working with 90% felons. Again, back to your statement, you didn't pick those people. But from those people, then you guys are working, you're doing your thing. Can you not go have lunch with the guy or gal?
Well, that therein lies the question. Where does it transgress from being totally uncontrollable to within your control? Certainly you can control who you go out and have personal actions with. If it's a group, if the company is providing for a lunch and people are expected to attend, that would be one choice. If you're deciding to kick back after work and go out and let off some steam and go bowling, well, then have we moved into a personal relationship that is of your choosing and is of under your control?
And that would just be outright prohibited, period, end of story?
I think it could be under the directions they've given, because you've been told not to associate with known felons. So you moved from an environment where it was not within your control to an environment where it is within your control. So if you have the information that the person is a known felon and you've engaged in a voluntary relationship outside that environment, which you do not control, it would seem like they would have a plausible claim they could make that you're disregarding the condition to not associate.
Got it. If we roll the clock back maybe 40 or so years, I can't remember where I read it. Maybe it was in something like Reason magazine, where the probation model at the time was something of a, what would be a word? Something like an advocacy kind of situation where you're assigned, call them a sponsor, and they are to help you when you get released to get back into society. I don't know if they help you get a job. I don't know if they help you get some clothes, but they're there as a support, as a shoulder to lean on to help you get back in so you can get a job and pay your taxes and so forth and get back into society. It doesn't feel like the environment that we're in now is anywhere near that model.
Well, it doesn't only it doesn't feel that way because we aren't in that model. There was a time when the United States was a leader in the world in terms of correctional thinking, in terms of designing prisons and designing rehabilitation and trying to come up with a model that would reintegrate people back into society. And what you're referring to is what was called the medical model. And there was a time where in America, many states and the federal system believed that whatever caused the person to offend could be treated, and that rehabilitation was the ultimate benefit of society. So a lot more effort was put into rehabilitation in decades past. Probably the 60s and early 70s would be in the heyday of when the medical model was in operation. But as people saw the crime rates continue to escalate, at least the perception of crime, attitudes changed in the 80s and 90s, and punishment became the purpose of our justice system. And rehabilitation, if we're lucky, if it happens, it's okay as far as people are concerned. But punishment is the purpose, by and large. And there's not nearly as much emphasis. You could even take a state like Minnesota that was notoriously operating under the medical model prior to Governor Ventura. And I just draw that line as a date when attitudes even began to shift in Minnesota. And Minnesota is a lot more punitive now. They're certainly not like Alabama in the Southeast, but Minnesota has kind of jettisoned some of their belief in rehabilitation. And it's just what's happened in the intervening years when people have become fearful that crime is rampant and the punishment is the solution.
And do you think that there is evidence to support that idea that crime is rampant and it's on the rise and all this, that your house is going to be broken into in the next 24 hours?
Well, there's the statistics on a national scale don't support that. In fact, the statistics on a national scale are just the opposite. Crime has actually been declining, and we're at historical lows, at least in modern times. And then people will point to a city like Chicago, and they'll say, look at the homicide and violence rate in Chicago. And there are other cities where violence is significant and probably comparable to the all-time highs, if not even at all-time highs. But as far as if you look at the nation, that's just not the case. Crime has actually been trending down for a good 25 years. So the fear is not founded. You're safer now. In the average city, you're safer now being alive than at any time in my lifetime. And I'm knocking at the door 60 years old. And I feel far safer now than I felt in the 70s because of the technology, the observation. There are cameras everywhere. So there's real-time monitoring of the streets of most cities in this country. Most individuals are carrying technology that allows them to instantly communicate when you had to look for a telephone
right
in the past, trying to figure out how to get some attention to yourself. The forensics techniques have enhanced solvability of crimes, which has also had a deterring effect when people know that they're going to get caught. So crime, I feel safer being alive today than any time in my life, but that's just me. That's not the average person. They don't feel that way. I think probably because they haven't taken time to analyze the real facts.
Yeah, I was going to say, is it you that's burying your head in the sand, or is it the other people that are, I don't know, watching too much sensationalized news?
Well, I just go by the data from the uniform crime statistics that are produced. Now, I suppose that police agencies could deliberately withhold their reporting of crime, and people could quit reporting to the police because it's going to, I mean, you'd have to buy into a theory that folks have stopped reporting when they're a victim of violent crime, and that the police have deliberately not reported them to be compiled in uniform crime statistics. That has to be a lot of conspiratorial activity that would take place. But I frankly actually believe the statistics are fairly accurate, that the reflection of what we see in statistics is indicative that crime, and particularly violent crime, has been on a decline for a number of years.
To support what you're saying, it was yesterday or a day before, I ended up at a website that was on the opposite side of what you're saying. So I was just trying to see where I could find some data, and I ended up at the FBI's website for, I guess, like missing persons. And I don't want to go too far down this rabbit hole, but it seems highly unlikely to me that if your child or your sister or your brother went missing, that you wouldn't report it. So I got to think that those numbers are short of 100% accurate, minus a handful of however that would have come about that it didn't get reported. But I got to think that the numbers that they have, and they're in line with some very, very small decimal point kind of number, where if a specifically a child is taken, the odds are ridiculously high that the child will be returned.
Well, that is particularly true in terms of child abduction. In a country of 300 million plus people, the number of stranger abductions is just remarkably low. It's somewhere in the low 100 range.
Yes, yes, yes.
And there are thousands that are abducted and non-custodial parent abductions, which the parent that has not doesn't have the legal custody decides that they're going to make the judgment for themselves that the child's better off with them. But in terms of abductions that are not related to familial circumstances, it's an extraordinarily low number of, and it has not been going up. It's in fact been going down. It's usually in the 100 to 150 range. The stranger danger is exceedingly low.
Right. So how about if we talk about conditions of supervision a little bit more detailed? And I think I want to try and drive these towards, no one's going to know all 27 amendments, but you know, maybe if we covered, again, we did cover this before about like the Second Amendment and the Fourth Amendment, but I think I want to focus more specifically against maybe the First Amendment and Fifth, where you have the freedom of speech and expression, and also your right to not incriminate yourself, which I guess we covered a little bit in the polygraph side, but I guess, you know, if you end up under the re-custody, like you get interrogated by your probation officer about activities that you're doing, so in your activities, so let's go over the First Amendment first. What restrictions can probation put against you in regards to the entire reading of the First Amendment, not just that you can speak, but also that you have the right to receive information, if I'm not mistaken, and you would then also have the right to assemble, and you have the right to religious freedom. I think I got everything in there.
I think you covered it as well as I know it.
So can they pull back on you in those activities? Forget like the religious side. I don't want to say forget. If you were going to put yourself in a situation with children, yes, that completely makes sense that they would be able to pull back on you on that. Otherwise, can they stop you from speaking, expressing your right to free speech?
Some of these questions are not clearly answerable because they're unique to the circumstances of that offender. And you hit the first part, like in church, if they were to issue for either type of supervision we talked about, whether it be probation or parole, any type of community supervision, if they were to issue a directive that you would cease and desist from having any outside worship option, that under direct challenge would probably not be sustained by the courts. I can't think of a scenario where that would be sustainable, that they would tell you to cease and desist. But if they were to more narrowly tailor that and say cease and desist from a particular congregation or from churches that have no inadequate supervision, I could see, based on the offender characteristics, narrowing that religious freedom, as long as there were alternative options for worship being provided, so that it was not a blanket prohibition. So it would all come down to reasonableness in terms of the worship component. In terms of the assembly, there again there would be some right of a probation officer to restrict one's assembly depending on where they were going to assemble at. I don't think that you could make the argument that I'm on supervision in state A and I have the right to go assemble in state B because there's a great conference that's dealing with issues I'm interested in, because that interferes with the ability to supervise the offender if a person's traveling from state A to state B. So they could perhaps say, nope, you can't do that assembly. But if they were to issue a blanket directive that you can't engage in any assemblies, then they're going to run into some problems if that person were to challenge it. So it all comes down to an analysis of the offender and how much they can intrude based on that offender and how much it undermines the ability of the supervising officer to be in charge and be reasonably assured of where that offender is. Because when you get down to it, that is their job, is to be able to represent to whoever imposed that period of supervision, be it a court or be it a parole board, that they're doing their best to keep that offender on the straight and narrow. And the more tools you take away from them, the more difficult it is for them to fulfill that role.
I am thinking of, so right after the inauguration, the following day, there was the Women's March. 300,000 people were on the Washington Mall. Could they say, specifically if you were in D.C., it seems hard for them to say, no, you cannot go. But even from other states, do you think they would have much standing to say, no, you can't go march on that type of environment?
I believe when you trigger the interstate travel, I believe they would be justified, and courts would uphold their prohibition. I think for people in the D.C. area, it would be much more difficult, but that it's all situational to the offender. If that offender, if you have this march, and that's going to put that offender into placement in situations that they would deem inappropriate for them, I could see that they could do a restriction on a particular offender, even in the D.C. area. But just say no offender under our supervision is going to go to the Women's March. I believe they would be treading in very, very difficult waters for the people that didn't have to travel. But there again, since the person who's being supervised does not enjoy the right to travel at will, prohibiting them from traveling from Atlanta to D.C. to be in a march, I think would be within a reasonableness that would be upheld by the courts, because you would have an ample opportunity to protest when such a thing comes to Atlanta, theoretically.
Sure. I was thinking of when we were just saying a few minutes ago about the likelihood of stranger danger of being snatched off the street is just so very low, then why would they protest you traveling to do something of that nature? Going back to your First Amendment privileges, though, isn't that... It seems really gray to me. It seems really like that would be a struggle for them to justify it, unless you were just known to be that kind of person. But to just make it a blanket that nobody can do it, that just doesn't feel right to me.
Well, it may not feel right to you, but a person under supervision is enjoying conditional liberty.
Okay.
And with that conditional liberty, they have restrictions, and those restrictions. You would not, if they had not given you conditional liberty, if they had given you behind jail cell, you wouldn't be traveling to D.C.
Certainly that.
So the conditional liberty has a lot of restrictions. And there again, the probation officer has a lot more difficult time supervising you when you're out of the territory. Now, with the advent of modern technology, it's more feasible to supervise a person who's out of state today than it was just a few short years ago. Because today I believe, if I understand GPS monitoring, there's real-time monitoring, and I don't believe it's exclusive to a geographic area. I believe the GPS would show where you were, but just because it shows where you were doesn't mean you know that area. So it's not that particular officer's territory. They may not be able to pinpoint the places you shouldn't be in that area, but I believe they could actually monitor you in real time.
Oh, totally.
If you were to travel across state lines and know where you were.
You could use like just an app like Waze, if you're familiar with that, and turn on to, you were going to share the location, and then I know what time you are arriving back at my place. Or, you know, if we're meeting somewhere, I will know what time you are arriving because you shared that. Google Maps also has that feature as well.
So if a person flies from Atlanta to D.C. and they're moving around the D.C. metro, would a probation officer in Atlanta be able to know what those little dots are and where theoretically some locations that a person should not be going to? Would they be able to decipher that on the grid that they would see from DC? And would they see a grid? I don't know enough about how this works, but it seems plausible to me that they could.
Absolutely. As far, you know, however much resolution the map gives you, that's a different part of the conversation, but for them to know exactly where you are, like a 10-digit grid X and Y, to know where you are on the face of the earth, they totally can know in real time where you are. So it's, you know, if your probation officer wants to let you go and wants to employ some technology, they could say, hey, at any time, if I request it, you have to share your location with me so I can see where you are. And you could click a couple buttons on your phone and they would know where you are. They could drill in and see if you're near a school, church, playground, perhaps, but they would know that you are roughly where you said you're going to be.
So Well, I'm a believer that technology correctly used can be a major asset in supervision. Unfortunately, as we talked about on a previous podcast, there's the temptation and the likelihood that it's going to be misused rather than correctly used. But if the probation officer could adequately supervise a person, I think that some of the travel restrictions should be relaxed. But it typically takes us some time to catch up with technology in terms of the benefit, because you have to want to do something differently.
Right.
How many times have you heard in your life when you ask, why are we doing this? It's because we've always done it this way.
We've always done it that way.
And it requires you rethinking why you've always done it that way. Well, as a general rule, restrictions on travel have been a part of probation supervision as long as I can remember. So for that to break down, it's going to take some time, even with the advent of technology. I believe that they could probably monitor your usage for alcohol and drugs through. I know there's a tracking device that will monitor skin contact for alcohol.
Okay.
And so they could, if you had a drinking problem, they could monitor that. I don't know about the use of drugs, if there's anything other than the invasive test that they use, like the swab of the cheek or the urine specimen and their hair analysis. I don't know if there's any device that will do that.
Okay. Well, then how about, let's make some comparisons between like physical proximity and then maybe using a telephone. And I want to extend it out further to using the internet. So you and I having this conversation, could they say that you and I cannot meet at the local Mexican restaurant to have this type of conversation?
Well, while you're under supervision, if they were to say that, I believe that they probably could get away with it.
So they could,
because you're engaging in a personal relationship, and we would have to really slice and dice that in terms of your advocacy for redress of your grievances, and it would get dicey, and it would be a long battle if they were trying to prevent this of us from having contact with one another in a physical location.
And so where I wanted to go with that then is, could we do it over a telephone? Would that be acceptable?
I believe that they could still, if they knew beyond all reasonable doubt that you were talking to me, they could object even over the telephone, because of their assertion would be a negative influence. And some of these things we don't know the answer unless there's a challenge, and someone has to be willing to say, no, I'm going to disregard you, and we're going to find out what the court says, and then we run it through the appellate process. But I believe telling a person that you ought not be having any engagement with someone that they don't deem appropriate, in particular if they've got a felony conviction, is probably within their ability to do.
Could you use the internet to do it, say through something like Skype or what we're using here?
Well, all of these questions are questions that really there's not an exact answer to. Everything is, the answer is they can do it until they're told that they can't. And the way they're told that they can't is by someone saying, I choose to challenge you on this. I believe that a compelling case could be made that as a part of petition government for redress of your grievances, that there would be people, if you think about in colonial times, do you believe that the king would have had problems with what some of the colonists were doing?
I would think that would be a yes.
Yes. So there would be people who would look at what we're doing and saying, well, if we're being denied constitutional rights, how would we ever? I mean, who would you get to help petition except for those who are being denied? Very few people. It takes a unique individual to petition for redress of someone else's grievances.
Yes, definitely. So, I think those are called lawyers, aren't they?
And they get paid to do it, but the people most impacted are going to be the ones who are going to have the grievance and be willing to. So it would be very dicey for them to say we could not communicate in any fashion, but I believe they could make a compelling case for it, and I believe that we could make a counter case, and then we would be embroiled in litigation if the issue needed to be pressed to the bitter conclusion if they didn't back off.
I'm trying to establish what would be the difference of, especially in the modern era where, you know, when the First Amendment was written, there wasn't any way to communicate over long distance unless you were using smoke signals or candles or something, to then where we have telephones. So that's 120 or 100 year. I don't know when the telegraph came into play. Probably in the late 1800s-ish was the telegraph.
Yeah, I believe the phone was invented about 1870, somewhere in there.
And
telegraph lines were in use in the Civil War, so I think they predate the telephone.
Okay. Yeah, though, definitely. And then, but now, through, I got to make the analog, the similarity that communicating over a single wire with a guy clicking a little clicker doing Morse code from one coast to the other is identical to me sitting here and communicating with someone in Russia or Japan or Australia or across the street. It's not functionally different. Technologically, it's different.
Well, I agree with you. In those days of colonial times, there would have been, I mean, the town crier would have been how you got your information, that and through printed publications that took forever to get to you. So assembly would have been pretty much in person. And now we can assemble without being in person. So I would agree with you. But frequently the courts and the statutes don't catch up for some time. So in order for this issue to be adequately resolved, people who are being told that they cannot do these things are going to have to say, well, actually, I can. And okay. I intend to do these things. And we'll have to find out what the courts say and how they interpret the First Amendment. We have to hope that we have courts that are a little bit more believing in the evolvement of things. So there's the strict constructionist view.
Right.
And I had this discussion earlier today, and I don't want to go too far off topic, but I had the discussion earlier today about banishment. And I was asked, well, this Texas law in Meadows Park or whatever city it is, why doesn't this constitute banishment?
Right.
And I said, well, it depends on what your definition of banishment is, because it is a form of banishment. But you take the conservative people, the literalists that believe the Constitution is to be interpreted consistent with how the words were understood at the time.
Right.
Well, in colonial times, banishment was understood as being told you must get out of town and never return.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in this particular instance, in most cases that where sex offenders are not allowed to live a place, they're not banished from town. They're not told you must leave town.
Right.
They're told you just can't buy a home, you can't rent an apartment, you can't sleep here at night. But you can be in town and you can shop and spend your money. So the absolute constructionists would say that's not banishment in terms of what we thought of banishment in the colonial times. Well, the same thing back to this here. If you look at a justice like the late Scalia or the more conservative wing like Alito or Thomas, if this issue were to go before them, that they might take a very narrow view of what assembly meant and say, well, that's what assembly means. And then you might look at the more liberal wing and you look at the Packingham decision as an example where they referred to the internet as being the modern town square. And the liberals were on one side of that, and the conservatives said, "Oh no, you're going too far. We think there's just too much runaway dicta in this opinion." So we're just going to have to litigate some of these issues to find out.
Wow, yeah. So you hit on it with where you had to go to the town hall to get your information. Now you can receive all of the same information through a virtual town hall, and your town hall doesn't have to be. Proximity, it could be interest-based. It could be, hey, I want to go organize and hang out and talk to people about dogs or registrant issues. That's and those cases haven't started bubbling up yet? They haven't been pushed through other than Packingham?
I'm not privy. I don't follow everything. But typically what happens when a person is under supervision, they're trying to ride out the storm.
Yeah.
And they're trying to complete their term of supervision. So they're faced with compliance or they're faced with non-compliance and being arrested. And then they're faced with expending resources that most don't have because most of these issues do not lend themselves well towards pro bono representation. So you end up in a situation where non-compliance can get you in trouble and you may end up winning the day later, years after you've served your time.
Right.
Because it would take years to litigate a case like this all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, as you've noticed with Packingham.
Yeah. Packingham was 6 years or so.
Something like that.
Right.
And it's a typical trajectory of 4 or 5, 6 years before something works its way all the way to the Supreme Court if they decide to hear it.
And that's a consistent challenge that we have just in general. It's, hey, I'm just going to ride this out and deal with it. And what I have been telling people regularly is I ask them this proverb, I ask them this question of when is the best time to plant a tree? And the answer is 20 years ago. Well, when's the second best time to plant a tree? Well, that's today. The reason why we have these challenges that we have today is because people yesterday haven't fought, weren't successful, whatever. So that's why we are dealing with these issues today. Well, the way that we make them better for our people tomorrow is, well, we have to fight today.
I agree, but each individual has to do a calculation for themselves.
Absolutely.
What sure. happens to them or their families if they make a stand?
Yeah.
Are they going to deprive themselves of any access to their children, or are they going to deprive themselves, their families, of what income stream that they're able to generate?
Right.
And it's a tough situation to be in.
Yep. Yeah, because we're not independently wealthy, most likely. All right. So let's talk more about the other restrictions, or maybe frame this in the attitude of the probationer in, I want to do the thing. So I do what I want, or I work where I want. I can hang out with whomever I wish. I'm going to travel. You're not coming in my car, and I want to stay out all night. What do you think about those ideas?
Those would be, if a person adopted all of those or even some of those, they probably would not be successful on supervision, because I can't imagine other than unsupervised probation that they would get away with asserting those rights, because they don't have those rights. They can't stay out all night if they're given a curfew. They can't travel at will. They can't hang out with whomever they want. And employment restrictions are appropriate. I think even the most seasoned advocate would admit that there would be employment situations that would be detrimental to offender. Would you put a person who had an embezzlement problem?
Right.
Would at you let them be an accounting and a chief financial officer for a company?
Absolutely. I totally see where that goes. It makes sense to me. However, with registrants specifically, it's just like, hey, don't come out of your house and everything will be fine. That seems to be what the mental model is of the restrictions that are placed upon us.
Well, that's true. We're told a lot of things are for our own good. And it's kind of like when the officer handcuffs you and your blood's not circulating and your extremities are turning white. I just can't take much more of this. And the officer's telling you it's for your own good. Well, that's kind of what they tell people who are under sex offender style supervision, that a lot of this stuff is for their own good. And it's hard for you to see that all this stuff is for their own good. I mean, there could be some very prudent steps to take that would be for your own good, to extract yourself from situations where there'd be any doubt. But to totally discontinue living life and stay home. And then they tell you to stay home, they tell you not to have any sexual stimuli.
Mm-hmm.
You're just somehow supposed to forget that you have a legitimate sexual need while you're a human being. It's hard to imagine that this is done just for your own good. I haven't sat on the meetings where they designed these conditions, but you almost look like that there's some power play going on to just see how tight the screws can be and what they can think of next. I think that they've exceeded what's for their own good of the person under supervision.
Along with what we discussed earlier about being tailored to the individual, that these are just tailored to the everybody. And maybe your condition was, you know, something where you were in proximity and you did snatch a stranger, forbid. But so you can't be around those places. But if your crime was with an adult and you were in your house, what does that have to do with you being around a park?
That's the question that I ask. Probably if you were to go back to the days when conditions were somewhat tailored to the individual, you would find a lot of the registrants who would be in favor of that. I would say that I don't know what percentage would be. We haven't taken a poll, but I would believe that if they were uniquely tailoring conditions of probation, most people would be able in a rational conversation to understand how that was tailored to them, if it truly had been tailored to them.
Right.
If they said, sir, we can't let you do this because this is the reason why. And the only reason they give you is the reason that no one likes is because it's our rule.
Right.
And we do this to everybody.
Yes.
But if a person has a proclivity to make obscene telephone calls.
Right.
And that's all that they do in their criminality, it would be very reasonable to take great precautions in terms of how that they have access to telephones and maybe monitor their device very closely. But if a person has never had any misuse of the telephone, you probably wouldn't want to spend your energy on that person in terms of the phone. Well, from what I hear these days, that everybody's getting their phones scrutinized in some capacity when they're under supervision. And to me, that's just a total invasion and unnecessary, just like we drug test everybody. Well, really? Okay, well, you've had the person under supervision for 4 years. You've drug tested them every month for 4 years, and you haven't done anything other than spend the public's money. Why are you doing that? Well, but that's just what we do. Well, no, but why are you doing that? Because you spent time and money on that, and you could have spent a little bit of that time and money on actually helping that person with a legitimate problem that they're having. So I can't answer the whys, but I can tell you that until we have a return to the desire to rehabilitate and use this medical model or some variation of that, we're not going to see a dramatic change. The more harsh they can make conditions, that's what's going to keep happening as long as that's reflective of the mood of the people.
And who does probation report to? What branch of the government would they fall under?
Well, generally speaking, that would be the executive branch. Most administrative matters are under the executive. So the legislative branch is going to design the curriculum, and the executive branch is going to execute the curriculum. So most of the time, it's either going to be under the state executive or a local executive. Some of the states, as I understand it, are very decentralized in probation, and a lot of the policies are made at the county level. But I know in my state and a number of states, we have the state division of probation and parole, and they unified the supervision. Whether you're on parole or probation, you're in the same system. So if you're serving dual probation and parole at the same time, you see one officer. I hear these places, I got to report to my parole officer today, and then I got to see my probation officer too. I said, well, what kind of nonsense is that? Where do you live at? Oh, I live in Ohio. And I said, well, I thought you people were going broke in Ohio. Mm-hmm. Why are you having, we have the division, or we have two different agencies. One does probation, one does parole. Well, it's not that way here, and that doesn't seem to be very efficient to do that. And then they even take it further, and they have different conditions for the two supervision modalities. So you'll be allowed to do something under parole, and you're not allowed, your probation officer tells you, or vice versa, that you can't do that.
Okay. So how about probation's obligation to follow an order given by the court that is in direct conflict with a law that's been signed into law by the governor of the state?
Well, do you have a particular example that would help zero in on what you're talking about here?
It is my understanding in Georgia that there is a situation that's not happening necessarily everywhere, but in a lot of places where judges are signing a standing order, and there's no case number by it. There's no plaintiffs or defendants in it. It's just a standing order that says this court says that sex offenders, because of their frightening and high recidivism rate, blah, 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 that they will not get unsupervised probation. And my understanding of unsupervised probation, which I have it on our list here to go over in a few minutes, is that perhaps you wouldn't have visits from probation. You wouldn't necessarily have your monthly fees and so forth. So I'm really asking from a broad standpoint, what is probation's obligation to follow an order, something like that?
Well, is there a contradictory statute that says something that's totally opposite to that? So the judge decides he wants people in his or her circuit to be supervised. What does the statute say?
The law reads that after 2 years, everyone shall be put on unsupervised probation. And there's a couple exceptions with some fees, and then there's one category of crime where if you're a part of terrorism, something or another.
Well, in a perfect world, the answer to that question would be that probation would say, sorry, judge, this is an unlawful order. And they would appeal the order, and they would say, judge, we just can't do this because we're sworn to follow the law. And so are you. But we're not in a perfect world. And I suspect that that's not likely to happen in Georgia. I suspect that the probation authorities are going to do just the opposite. They're going to say, well, we have to follow the the order of the court, because if we didn't, we'd be held in contempt. So I believe that they would have an obligation to follow the law rather than the order of the court, but it is dicey for them. And I guess the bigger question would be, what's the origin of these orders? Do you think that a judge just woke up one day and decided to start issuing orders? Or do you think that probation is somehow behind these orders to have these directives issued? Could it be that probation wants to continue supervising people? That would be my speculation, because how would the court ever think about something like this on their own? Sua sponte, as it's referred to in legal jargon.
Tell me that word again.
Sua sponte.
Sua sponte. I guess there's some something with spontaneous in there. Well, yes. but isn't probation equally violating the law?
I believe they are. I believe that they're violating the law, and I believe this would be an actionable challenge.
No, but I mean, do you see what I'm asking? Is that so? They would say, well, we have to follow the order of the court, or else we'll be found in contempt. But aren't they equally violating the law?
I believe that you have probation would have a defense to the contempt citation, because in a contempt citation, there's an order issued to show cause, and before a party's held in contempt. So, hypothetically, if I had a Georgia law license, and such an order to issue, order to show cause were issued, the first thing I would come in is, as I would come in and say, here's the statute. It says that we shall do this. So therefore, your order is contrary to this, Your Honor. So therefore, my client should not be held in contempt. So this is the show cause. The cause is that the statute trumps you. And that would be difficult. And it's not likely that a probation system is going to want to do that, because there again, we're going back to the elected executive branch. And there would be some who would see this as fighting for the criminal offender's rights at the expense of the, I mean, probation is going to say, oh, we're doing this for public safety.
Of course.
The judge is going to say, we're doing this for public safety. So I don't see this battle ever going down, but that would be, in a perfect world, that's what probation should do, is they should tell the judge we can't do that because it's unlawful.
But as my understanding of how the elected officials got in place, we, the people, voted for them. They wrote the bill. The governor signed it. Now it's law. And that's the end of that conversation. Then the judges are just supposed to say, okay, well, we're going to apply these laws, and you are either in compliance or not.
In a perfect world, that would be what the judge would do. But too often we have judges who decide to legislate from the bench. And amazingly, depending on what they're legislating from the bench and depending on the political perspective of the person, some legislating from the bench is okay if it serves your agenda. And so most conservatives, people who are punishment, lock them up, throw away the key mentality, this type of legislating from the bench would be just fine.
Of course.
But if they were to legislate from the bench on something like the right to marry a person, that's legislating from the bench. We don't need that.
No. I totally get it.
That should have gone through the people, and it should have been voted on by the people. And by golly, if the people don't ratify that, that's not what the people want. And who the hell are these people wearing these black robes to think they can legislate from the bench?
Certainly. Yeah. So it's okay on one hand, but not okay on the other.
If it's your agenda.
Absolutely.
There's a fair amount of hypocrisy in the average person. And I'm one of those who tends to want to call people out on the hypocrisy. And I ask people to do the same with me.
Yes.
If they see that I'm being a hypocrite, because consistency is what we should strive for. And even though there are people who believe that supervised periods should be longer than 2 years, you had your chance to make that case through the legislative process.
Right.
And if you didn't, think 2 years was sufficient, you should have made your case there.
Right. Okay. I'm with you. What about, so probation is the ones that are going to assign you a curfew and so forth. Are there state level probation conditions that might be imposed?
Well, conditions can come about through a variety of places. So we've focused so far primarily on probation, but where you have parole, those are normally those conditions are primarily imposed by the parole board of the state. But in terms of probation, the probation can be the court itself, after hearing a sentencing argument and knowing the unique facts of the case, can impose such conditions as special conditions that the court deems appropriate. And they generally, there's language of the standard conditions. You shall apply with standard conditions of probation and the following special conditions, and they'll be articulated. But then when you get beyond the court, you get into situations where you get to your probation officer's setting, and the probation officer says, and by the way, in addition to all that stuff you heard in court, you've got to do this. And you look very carefully and you say, well, that's not in what the court said. And then they say, well, but if you look very carefully, you're to follow the directions of your probation officer. And these are the directions I'm giving you. So you have conditions that are imposed by the court, and you have conditions that are imposed by the supervising authorities. And they're both valid. The court is going to be very upset if you don't follow its conditions. They may cut you a little bit more slack on something that of a technical nature that's been imposed by supervising authorities. But they're both important to follow because they can both result in a violation.
Okay, I think I follow that. What would be the discretion of the probation officer to extend or lessen supervision requirements? So, like, let's say standard-wise, you have a curfew of 7 o'clock, and then they decide to give you a midnight curfew. Do you think then that there's like a model of curfew that is given to them by their supervisor, and then they kind of tailor it within that certain window?
That's my understanding. So if the court says standard conditions, if the probation supervising authorities change their standard conditions, the court's not particularly concerned about that.
Right.
Unless it undermines one of their special conditions. But the special conditions are the ones the court is most concerned about, because you've had due process theoretically.
Yep.
And the judge has decided that you need this special condition. So if the curfew were to go up and down, or it'd be no curfew at all, most courts wouldn't be concerned about that unless they imposed a curfew as a special condition of their own. And then that would take priority over what the probation department would say, because the probation says you don't have a curfew. The judge says you've got a rank issue there about in terms of who has the seniority and the rank.
Okay. And can you give me some examples of special conditions for registrants that you're aware of across the country? Maybe even, I guess, if you can think of the most egregious ones.
Well, tell you, we could spend almost a show on this with this, because they just continue to proliferate. Like, my state has a behavioral contract, and it just grows each year when they do their revision. But the most common special conditions will start that are common to everybody, is particularly if the team containment model is being used for supervision. Is that you don't have any you're going to be polygraphed, you're generally going to have a curfew, and you're generally going to be in treatment that's approved by the state.
Right. And that keeps you from doing your own hokey pokey that, like, I'll just sign off on you in 2 weeks.
So correct. That would be theoretically that you're going out and finding your own treatment professional. But then you start getting into special conditions about proximity. So they'll give you conditions of sex offender conditions, like not be on a playground, not go to a school function, not do things. Well, these offenders have children of their own, so they're cut out of their lives.
Mm-hmm.
Because they can't be in the proximity of a very common one. It's not to have any unsupervised contact with a minor.
Right.
Unless it's approved by the treatment provider and the probation officer. Well, if you want to get technical, that might even cut you out of some work, because there might be jobs where that they employ people 16 is the legal age to work in most states.
Oh,
so
true.
You may be unloading the truck that backs up to Wendy's, and there may not be any direct supervision, so you're mm-hmm. violating your term of supervision.
So they have
those kind of conditions, like don't possess any stimuli. I think we talked about that earlier.
Briefly, yeah.
And as if you're supposed to become asexual while you're under supervision.
Yep.
In my state, they have on the behavioral contract, you're not to stay at a hotel. So if the pipe bursts at your house,
right,
and you need to get out, you're not allowed to rent a hotel room for the night without prior approval. And no, they would tell you that their argument for that special condition is that they don't want anybody engaging in any sexual activity, because you just might go to a hotel and have sex. That's one of the things that people use hotel rooms for. Can you imagine that?
I'm shocked. And I think they also use, like, possibly the back seats of cars or just your normal bedroom.
Well, they prohibit in my state adult relationships that have not been prior approved. So it just goes on and on.
That for a minute. How can they stop that? If we've already determined by the Supreme Court that you cannot control who you love, so we have same-sex marriage because of that, then how can they, while you're on probation, you hang out with someone enough time and then you end up establishing something of a more permanent relationship with them. And that is on their discretion to say no?
That's what's in the contract. Now, there again, like we were discussing earlier, if a person were to assert that they have the right to engage in relationships with someone they're choosing, how far would you be able to go with that in terms of a constitutional argument? But I just pulled up the 13 version. I haven't pulled down a recent version of the behavioral contract. But as of 13, this contract, let me go through all the, it goes on and on and on. I think I'm on page 5 before there's a signature. And I think they've added another page to the behavioral contract. But I will not pick up hitchhikers. Yeah. I will not have a post office box unless approved by my probation officer. I will avoid areas known to have active prostitution activities. I will not engage in cruising. Cruising is defined as driving by or frequenting a location for the purposes of identifying potential victims. Now, of course, in my time, you cruised because you wanted to hook up with somebody.
Absolutely.
And they weren't victims. It was voluntary. And then they say you will not have any romantic involvement or living arrangements with individuals without the individuals being informed of the sexual deviancy and criminal offenses. I will not engage in sexual relations in public areas. I think that's a reasonable one. But a lot of this stuff in here is just nonsense.
It is. It seems a little aggressive.
I will not patronize any establishment with sexual or material or entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
So
no strip clubs and no adult stores. All right,
like
then.
I say, asexual is what you need to be.
Wow. And if I'm not mistaken, by attacking the problem from that point of view, you will likely exacerbate the problem because those drives are going to get out somehow.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Well, enough of that. Sorry. That's enough of a rabbit hole there. Well,
here's the hotel. You will not frequent, acquire, purchase, go to, or reside at any hotel, motel, whether for an hour or a night without prior permission of your probation officer.
Well, what about the conference? That's at a hotel.
Well, the no one in New Mexico is allowed to attend a conference.
Even professionally? You've got a big state that would be tough to pull off not traveling somewhere within the state to attend a conference, even for professional development.
Well, the rules are clear. You can't do it. I mean, you'd have to get prior approval. So, I don't know what circumstances they approve it, but it's certainly a violation if it's not approved.
Wow. What about electronic monitoring? I guess that could come with a whole bunch of different things of leg monitors, or if you have surveillance through your cell phone that tracks your location, they can impose all that on you?
Well, electronic monitoring has become commonplace in all correctional settings these days, in pretrial settings. And post-trial settings for supervision. So in fact, it's the state statute in my state that if a person has been convicted of any one of a few enumerated sex offenses, they will be monitored in real-time GPS for the duration of their period of parole. So real-time monitoring is it's an invasion into your, it's clearly a search, but there again, your conditional liberty. You're foregoing the privacy that you would have as a normal citizen to be free of that intrusion. There was a case in North Carolina that went to the U.S. Supreme Court where North Carolina claimed that the GPS monitoring that they'd imposed post-probation, post-parole, this is for people who have certain level sex offenses, it was just going to be a condition of registration. And that was challenged, and the North Carolina argued that it really wasn't a search and seizure, and the court just per curiam, which is by all justices, laughed at that and said, of course, this is a search.
Okay.
So,
but what about the fees associated with that electronic monitoring? Those are not cheap programs, even though I don't see what the expense actually is from a technical standpoint, but those things are in the hundreds per month.
I've heard of horror stories of people not being able to afford the fees and then being violated. And that's amounts to a debtor's prison, which we supposedly mm-hmm. got rid of in the United States. But I have heard of that. It hasn't been a real big problem in my state, but I hear of it from other states that there's horrendous costs that relate to polygraphs. So if you've got the polygraph, you've got the probation, the general supervision fee, then you've got the electronic monitoring fee, then you've got mm-hmm. the treatment cost
mm-hmm.
to go to their approved treatment provider.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got oftentimes the southern states are particularly bad about imposing fines because that's part of how they fund their massive criminal justice system. So you've got a fine to pay that's added to all those other monthly costs. And you look at all those things and you just wonder how a person that's going to work for minimum wage is going to acquire the financial resources to do this.
There's an individual, I spoke to his mother recently, and he's working at a job. Maybe he's making $600. Maybe he's making $700 a month. And between treatment, fees, probation, polygraph, et cetera, he is out $400 and he only makes $600. And then he's still got to like pay rent and get food and transportation out of that as well.
And clearly he's not doing that on money he's earning. So he's one of the fortunate ones that has some help.
Yes.
But what about the unfortunate one who doesn't have any help?
Yeah, I'm not really sure what they're supposed to do other than just say, all right, it's going to be better for me in prison this way. I don't know that you would have any other choice. Yeah, fine, you're free and you can watch a movie, but you're starving to death. You may as well just go back inside and then charge the state some real money.
It's one of those unfortunate things that society does not see as being a problem. We'll be digressing to a new topic, but we've got hundreds in my state in prison that are what we call release eligible, meaning they've totaled out their sentence, and then we impose a period of parole with all felony offenses, and it varies from offense to offense, and many of the sex offenses it's an indeterminate period, but because the person has a period of supervision, the parole board imposes a condition they live in suitable housing. Well, there again, you start running into what's suitable housing. So you've got hundreds of people sitting in prison. I think last count around 300, the overwhelming majority of them were sexual offenses, sitting in prison at the cost of tens of thousands per year.
Right.
You could do community reintegration for a third to a half of that and do good programming at a community rehab center, reintegration center. You could do that, but the taxpayers were not interested in that. If you ask the average taxpayer, would you rather keep this person in prison, even though it costs more? The average person for a sex offense would say yes.
Yeah.
No price is too great to bear when it comes to these kind of people.
Sure.
So and it's a problem across the country. We hear about it from Illinois. We hear about it from states all over the country that people are just sitting in prison. Colorado, my neighbor to the north. So I suspect it's a problem in practically every state that people are sitting in prison. They're eligible to be released simply because there's nowhere to go.
Mm. What about the tactics that probation uses? We were discussing earlier about a treatment kind of model versus a militant kind of model is what it is now. So probation officers are wearing combat boots and cargo pants, and they're wearing tactical gear with vests and all the Velcro pockets. They're carrying tasers and guns and handcuffs. And when they walk in your house or when you encounter them, you are very, very much intimidated.
Well, I would say that clearly that's not the medical model at work. You would de-escalate things with a medical model with very, very little insignia. It would be like a person that you'd be having a conversation with, and they would most likely be armed with some type of protection in case the situation escalated, but it would be very low key, and you would not think of them as being the SWAT team. But that's the way that the system has evolved in recent years, and a number of states are doing that. And not only are the probation officers armed in the way as you described, they're teaming up with real uniform agencies. So they're working in teams, going out, and they're going in people's homes as a part of a joint task force. So you'll have the local sheriff's office, sometimes the local police, the United States Marshal Service. So you feel like you're under a home invasion when they swarm in. And these things are questionable in terms of how far they can go with a person. There again, what's the challenge, and how do you go about it? How do you fund it? And where do you draw the line? Because they'll argue officer safety. They'll say, well, we do all this, Your Honor. We bring 27 people in. When you see the takedowns on To Catch a Predator, you see these feeble old men sometimes that are 60 years old, and they're wobbling around, overweight, and you see when they knock them to the ground, is that really necessary?
That would be a question for that's a good question.
But it makes the people doing it feel good, and apparently it appeals to people who see it happen. They like to see that level of force pulling all these guns when they're doing that. I don't think we can go back to the days of Andy Griffith where you didn't wear a gun. but I think that we could ratchet all this down many notches and have very few problems, because jails that use de-escalating techniques versus escalating techniques, I believe statistics support that. I know the Boulder County Jail used to be a very fine example of where they used de-escalating techniques. They didn't have officers in uniform, and they were a model of tranquility in terms of keeping offenders from escalating and how to handle them and what the minimal force necessary when there was a problem. And they went around the country, around the region, and around the country training those techniques. I don't know what's happened to this country, but apparently the more force is better, and I don't see any let up. Hmm. But I have problems with what I would call a home invasion, and I think that there's some areas that would be ripe for challenge in terms of how far over the top they're going.
Well, I mean, isn't that goes back to what you said of where you have a reduced expectation of privacy, and as well as that, if you have nothing to hide, what do you mind if they come in and snoop around?
Well, you do have the diminished expectation of privacy, but you also have an expectation that your family be treated with a little bit of respect because they didn't break the law. And you have an expectation that without some level of reasonable suspicion, you could go through the various levels, whether it be reasonable suspicion or probable cause, that if you're abiding by the rules, that they don't come toss your house. They don't come in and just have a pleasant word with you. When they come in that type of garb, with all that type of manpower, apparently, they need to justify the expenditure of that, and they come in and start tossing the place upside down, being very disrespectful, tearing up the offender stuff.
Right.
And that's kind of what happens in a shakedown in a prison. When you do a shakedown, yes, you've got institutional security, and you need to do a shakedown, and you need to try to outfox the criminals because they're very devious, and they're very creative. But if you go in and deliberately tear up their family's photographs that they struggle so hard to get, and you tear up the things that they make, that they put great hours of labor into deliberately because you can, that's an act of escalation. And they do that because it makes them feel good. It's not for institutional security. They do it because they can. And I don't have an answer for that.
Do you think that they're actually intending to do it to try and get you to step out and give them a reason to jump on you?
Well, it certainly would cause an average person to react in that fashion. That would be a rational reaction to a situation where you see that you think you're playing by the rules, and they deliberately are coming in to be heavy-handed. That would be a normal reaction. What can I do to please these people?
Right, right. And we touched on it just in passing. What is the difference between supervised and unsupervised or administrative probation, as it might be worded in various districts, jurisdictions?
Well, the line gets blurred because defense attorneys are creative and trying to avoid just what we've been talking about for the past hour, some of the excesses. So they'll try to negotiate for unsupervised probation, and the judge will try to split the baby down the middle and give them something titled unsupervised probation, but with requirements that they do certain things. And of course, in order for that to be monitored, there has to be a probation officer involved. You can't tell a person to do X, Y, Z, go get counseling, do this, that, and the other as a condition of probation, and then just hope for the best, and the court doesn't have time to monitor it. So you end up with blurred lines. But in a true unsupervised probation, it would be that a period of time of the court having control and the ability to revoke that period of time. When a person's on probation, the court can revoke that probation and impose usually whatever sentence would have been available at the beginning, or the sentence that could have been imposed at the beginning less the time that they've been on probation. So it's a period of time without any strings attached other than don't break the law. But with the variations that are imposed, you end up with something that's a partially supervised probation. But in the strictest sense, there would be no reporting requirements other than don't break the law for the next 3 years. If you get in any trouble, you'll be back before me, and I have a suspicion you'll be going to jail if you don't have a good explanation. That would be the truest unsupervised probation.
So when we talked earlier about curfews, so those would be gone. Could we go hang out with whomever we want at that point?
You could under truly unsupervised probation, because there again, if the court were to say, and don't hang out with a certain type of people, that needs someone to control it. So on unsupervised probation, you could hang out, do whatever you want to, stay out as late as you like.
Okay.
Don't break the law.
Okay. What about, what was I just going to say? I guess the home invasion would be one place. So if you're on unsupervised, when they do their Halloween compliance check, I can kind of see them coming in and checking to see if you are compliant with not handing out candy, et cetera. But what about the whole tossing of the house thing that we were just talking about?
Well, now, if you're under truly unsupervised probation, I don't know where there would be a prohibition against handing out candy unless it's in your state statute separate okay. from probation.
Okay.
But so I don't know where that there would be no such condition unless it was in a state statutory or local ordinance. So, but if you were truly unsupervised, I can't see how they would have any justification to come by your house. But without knowing the nuances of unsupervised yeah. probation across the country, I would not expect that we would be seeing a probation officer here in my state if you were on unsupervised probation. I wouldn't think of home visits. So that would say that there would be no tossing, there would be no search, because you would not be under the direct supervision of anybody who would have that authority.
Okay, I gotcha. And we're almost done, I think. I can only think of maybe one other question. What is involved, this may be a rabbit hole on its own, in a probation revocation? How does that come about? And I guess it varies from state to state on how that that whole process would go through.
Well, in a probation revocation, it's when we talk about probation, we're always talking about a court. So a court's involved in the imposition of probation, as contrasted with parole, which we've barely touched on. But in a probation revocation, as a general rule, there's been an allegation of a violation of one of the conditions of probation or many of the conditions of probation, or it could be that the person's been arrested, which in and of itself would be a violation of probation. So there's an initiation of a proceeding. Generally, it starts with a probation officer, hands off to a prosecutor who requests that the court hold a hearing, and the probation officer will generally be the primary witness in a revocation proceeding against the individual, particularly if it's on a condition of probation versus a new criminal charge. So there's a process by which the offender has the right to be heard, have the right to have counsel, and there's defenses that one can assert. But while under probation, remember, the offender is already convicted. They're already under the control of the court. So it doesn't take the same level of proof as it does to secure a new conviction. So since the liberty is conditional, the evidentiary standard is much lower, where you'd be looking at beyond a reasonable doubt. You're looking at usually what satisfies the conscience of the court, something like a preponderance of the evidence or something far short of beyond a reasonable doubt. Each state may word the standard a little bit differently, but the admissibility of evidence is less formalized in a probation revocation. Evidence that would not be admissible in a trial on the merits would be admissible. Here's certain forms of hearsay. So there's a different level of admissibility of evidence because you're already convicted of a crime. So you're going to have this revocation hearing. And if the standard is that the probation violation is more likely to have occurred, the judge can revoke that entire probation. Something short of that, anything short of that, send a person away for a period of time and then reinstate their probation. But there's any number, or they could decide to take no action at all after hearing the evidence. If the person could provide a satisfactory reason for why they did. I give an example. We had a client where the guy had gone on school grounds because his son was getting beat up.
Okay.
Because his dad was on the registry and he was in middle school, and he went on school grounds because he got word, and I believe it was by text in those days, but he got word that his son was in trouble and he went to school. And then he reported to his probation officer he'd done that. The probation officer said, that's fine. And then the supervisor said, no, that's not fine. It broke probation. So he went out and did an arrest and hold, which they have the authority to do, and took him before the judge. And I said, well, this is one where we're going to tell the judge that we did exactly what any father would do.
Right.
And that's exactly what you would do, Your Honor. And said it very nicely and respectfully, but the judge found that was a suitable defense to have your son with several stitches in his head had bashed over the head with a skateboard. Mm-hmm. So he found that was not an intentional, willful violation of probation.
Right.
That it was a necessity by circumstances beyond his control.
You and your legal terms. It's just great.
Unfortunately, the guy lost his job while he was sitting in jail.
Of course. Yeah, there's that element of the puzzle, of the ramifications of it. Going back to, I guess this kind of relates to debtor's prison. Maybe you know, you can afford to handle the jail part, but then when you get out, you've lost your apartment, you've lost your job, etc.
Well, that's what happened in this situation. He had a subsequent violation after that because of the losing his job, and it's so difficult to find a job. But probation violations are judicial, and there's a standard of evidence. There has to be some evidence, and it varies in terms of how sufficient the evidence has to be and what the judge might choose to do in terms of a sanction for the violation.
Is that universal? So a probation violation, you just use the term, it is a judicial process, and you have to go before the court.
I don't know of any probation revocation that hasn't gone before a court.
Okay.
Now, there might be a preliminary proceeding that wouldn't be done in a court, and we get into nuances of the Interstate Compact where people are entitled to a preliminary probable cause hearing, and there are states who do those preliminary proceedings in an administrative setting. But in terms of the revocation action, that in terms of whether or not a person is fully revoked, that's a judicial determination after a hearing, and the person pleads that they, when they ask, how do you plead, that usually you're pleading true or not true to the violation. And if you plead true to the violation, then they don't need to have the evidentiary hearing. Then the question becomes, what's the appropriate remedy? But if you plead not true, they have to put on some evidence to sustain the violation.
Wow. Interesting. I didn't realize that probation revocation was a judicial process. Okay.
Well, it is in terms of the final adjudication. Now, the different states provide officers different level. Like in my state, we have the STEPS program, and that's a graduated series of sanctions that probation is allowed to use that have been predetermined by the court. So a dirty UA might be 3 days in jail on a first offense, and then you never have to see the judge. So in that situation where there's a predetermined escalating level of steps, and this is supposedly rehabilitative because during the violative process, you don't ever have to risk going full violation, full revocation. There's these graduated sanctions that are imposed. So in that caveat, the probation officer could impose the sanction based on the pre-agreed upon steps program. And when a judge puts you on probation here, they order steps because they don't want the most frivolous violations. So they hand that power to the probation officer to impose graduated sanctions for lower level violations.
And a term you used a minute ago was UA, and that's a urine analysis?
That's a urine analysis, which is a very common test that's given to people, certainly right. In my state, and I think across the country, for determining noncompliance. Drug use constitutes a significant amount of the factors of those who fail. Drugs are a significant impediment to their rehabilitation if they can't control that. So that's a legitimate tool for those who have that issue. But it seems like that everybody in New Mexico has the issue of drugs because everybody gets drug tested. And that's just so untrue because there are a significant number of offenders who've never touched drugs.
Right, right. Do you have anything else you want to add?
Well, I think on the home invasion, I'd go a little further than what we went on the home invasion. The thing, these Halloween invasions that we talked about, they tend to extend beyond the supervised offender population. On those, when they form these joint task forces, they're going to people who are on the registry.
Right.
And they're going with the same team because they don't peel off and say, oh, well, we're going to a person who's paid their debt to society. So you have this same intimidating factor come into your door. Now, rather than being a probation officer who's the lead knock, it may be a sheriff.
Yep.
Or it may be a deputy U.S. Marshal. But you've got all this armaments around you, and they very intimidatingly ask, can they come in some instances? And a person who's not under supervision has no obligation to allow these people to intrude in their home. So that's when they intrude in their home and manipulate their way in. So when the marshals and team up with local law enforcement, which is typically sheriffs, sometimes local police, when they knock at the door, you've got this whole armada outside the door. And it has been reported to us on more than one occasion that they insist that they need to come in and do a visual inspection. And if the person's not under supervision, they don't have any obligation to allow the U.S. marshals, the deputy sheriff, or the local police to come into their house and do a visual inspection unless they are armed with a warrant.
So you are back to, even though you're on the registry and maybe you're in a state that has it for life, when law enforcement comes and knocks and says, hey, we need to come and check that, make sure that you're in compliance, you have the right to say negative.
That is correct. If you're not under any form of supervision, your home is still sacred, even if you're on the sex offender registry. Remember, the sex offender registry is a civil non-punitive regulatory scheme.
So they say.
And there's no obligation to allow a home search. Now, people do it because they feel intimidated, but you have no obligation to consent to a home search.
Okay. And I mean, how can they then go get the barricade and bust down your door and come in and really make your life hell?
Well, I mean, when you say, can they do it? It's physically possible. They can do it. There would very likely be the potential for adverse legal ramifications if they did and the person was not accepting of that outcome, because to break a door down without, I mean, now we could always have extra circumstances if they just witnessed somebody going to their into your house. But in normal circumstances, to break into your door without a judicial order would render that department and those law enforcement officers vulnerable to civil rights action. And so I would hope that they would not do it, but it does happen.
Interesting. Yeah, there was a person on the call the other night that talked about that, and even having himself and his family removed from the house while they came in and did their search.
Yeah, I'm not clear. I think he might have been under supervision.
Okay.
But a person who's not under supervision, clearly they have far more rights in terms of their privacy. Your conditional liberty is now full liberty.
Okay.
Once you've paid your debt to society.
Sure. Sure. Larry, this went way longer than I expected. We are at about 90 minutes at this point. There's probably some cutout. It'll cut it down just a few more minutes, but that is a lot. I didn't expect it to be that long. You are just an armada of information, and I thank you so very much.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. Look forward to being with you again in the future.
Wow. Thank you very much, Larry. Have a great night. Bye.
Bye.
Have a question? Send an email to registrymatterscast@gmail.com or leave a message at 747-227-4477. You can also leave comments on the website, registrymatters.co. This is episode 4. The outro music is Downtown by bensound.com. If you like the show, please share it with someone. We would appreciate it if you did. Thanks for listening.